Live from Tehran, this is World News. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has vowed that Tehran will make the occupation regime regret its deadly air raid on the Iran embassy in the Syrian capital. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the remark in a message of condolence on a martyrdom of a group of Iranian military advisors in the Monday's Israeli aerial raid on Syria. The leader described Israel as a hated occupying regime and vowed that the evil entity will be punished. Ayatollah Khamenei also saluted the martyrs of the attack, including two senior IRGC commanders, Major General Mohammad Reza Zahedi and General Mohammad Hadi Haji Rahimi. 13 people have been confirmed dead in Israel's Monday air raid on the Iran embassy in the Syrian capital. According to IRGC, the dead include two senior Iranian military personnel who are on an advisory mission to Syria and five of their accompanying officers. Meantime, Iran's Supreme National Security Council held an emergency meeting after the Israeli attack on the consular section of the Iranian embassy. It said that appropriate decisions were made over what it called another Israeli war crime against the people enjoying diplomatic immunity. Tehran also called for a UN Security Council meeting on the Israeli aggression. According to the Russian UN envoy, the Security Council will hold an emergency meeting today to discuss the attack on the Iranian embassy. The attack has violated international law and the 1961 Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations.
In a blatant violation of international laws and human norms, the Israeli regime committed a heinous crime by attacking the Consular Services Department of the Iranian Embassy in Damascus. The attack destroyed a four-story building, killing several people. Iran's ambassador to Damascus said that the crime will not go unanswered.
You can see how all the glass and windows of my room were shattered as a result of the attack while I was present in my room at that time. Some journalists were in the upper floor and witnessed it with their own eyes. We were speaking with the minister and they documented what happened in my room. The Zionist entity does not respect anything at all, and Iran will respond decisively.
The attack was met with strong condemnations from several countries at the global and regional levels. The Syrian people and their leadership insisted that such attacks must be confronted with more resilience and support for the Palestinian people and resistance movements. They affirmed that these barbaric attacks would further strengthen the bond between the Syrian and Iranian people.
We expressed our condolences for the loss of life and our sorrow over these unjustifiable attacks targeting diplomatic institutions. We emphasized the necessity of maintaining Syrian-Iranian relations because they are built on ethics and values, unlike Western countries that support Israel in committing such crimes.
Observers believe that the attack is a violation of international law and humanitarian principles and is a result of the regime's military defeat in its genocidal war on Gaza. They say such crimes increases the determination of the region's peoples to achieve victory and expel this cancerous entity. Even the peoples of the world have come to realize the criminality and brutality of Israel.
This Israeli entity, which by Western standards is regarded as the oasis of democracy in West Asia, only knows the democracy of killing, crimes, destruction, targeting children, women, residential buildings, and violating international law. This was evident in the targeting of the diplomatic consulate building.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps says seven of its officers, two of whom were brigadier generals, were killed in the attack.
Today's aggression is further evidence of the savagery and disrespect for international law exhibited by this criminal entity. This regime's behavior underscores the need for a firm response by the international community. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Now, in our news review program, we've discussed the deadly Israeli air raid on the consular section of the Iranian embassy in Damascus. The attack already sparked global condemnations. Let's see what our guests had to say.
Okay, let's discuss this a little further with our guests who are joining us for this. We have with us Dr. Fuad Izadi. He is a professor at the University of Tehran. Also joining us is Isha Krishnaswamy, podcaster and a journalist. Welcome to you both. Fuad Izadi, let me first start with you. We're looking at this terrorist act that Iran has called to have occurred, and obviously it has broken international rules regarding targeting an embassy. by the Israeli regime in this case. But what are the further ways of interpreting this when it comes to the way that the Israeli regime has reacted, which is unprecedented in terms of targeting not only the consulate, but also the fact that it belongs to the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Obviously, the genocidal regime in Palestine is trying to widen the war. They want to have United States and Iran enter into a military confrontation. They have failed miserably in their genocidal policies and practices in Gaza. They have only managed to kill women and children, destroy houses. They have achieved none of their goals. Their goals are not achievable, to be honest with you. And in order to put the attention on something else, they engage in this type of terrorist activities, and they are not going to be successful in this venture either. They're just showing the fact that they're criminals, they engage in war crimes, they engage in genocide, they engage in, you know, you don't use an airplane to attack a consulate in a foreign country. So overall, what we see is the true nature of the genocidal regime, and the more they engage in these type of activities, the more they show their true face. What Iran is doing is following international law. The Iranian government has asked for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council. UN Security Council has an opportunity to address this issue seriously. I doubt it, given the fact that another criminal regime, the United States, has a veto power in the Security Council. And the airplane that was used was an American airplane. The missiles that were used were American missiles. The money that was used was American money. And Americans are as much responsible for this criminal act as Israelis are. So Iran will follow international law. And also Iran will engage in activities to make sure this type of behavior is not repeated. So what Netanyahu is doing is trying to save his job, but I think he is making the end of Israel closer than what we think.
All right, so there's a lot of issues here, Isha, that we need to break open. One of them is the fact that, you know, it's said that the U.S. does not want to engage in a war with Iran, and that Israel is doing what it can with this in terms of a provocation to get Iran not only engaged militarily, but to pull in the U.S. How can they even think of that when they can't even be successful in the genocidal war in the Gaza Strip, which is obviously not even close to the strength that Iran has?
I think it is just because of that. So they need more and more partners to be drawn into this war. And an interesting thing is about 25 years ago this week, the U.S. started bombing Belgrade, Serbia, and they too bombed the Chinese embassy. So I think the precedent was set in that act. I just was thinking about that. Israel needs more partners in order to that can rain overwhelming firepower. So it seems like they're using the same strategy that many of the moderate rebels used in Syria when they faked chemical attacks. And it was a strategy to draw the West in on some kind of fake human rights violations. But with Iran, they're hoping that Iran reacts in a more militaristic way. And then there are many people in power who do want a war with Iran, just not the Biden administration right now. So there is a bit of an internal conflict in the U.S. with those who want to focus on China and those who want to strengthen the U.S. Occupation bases in the Middle East. And a lot of them have a really intense and strong relationship with the Netanyahu regime. And they also form the biggest Zionist lobby, and majority of them are Christian extremists. So the biggest Zionist lobby is Christians for Zionism. And so there are forces that, if given enough provocation, will be able to win the internal battle within the United States. And I think that's what Israel is hoping for.
All right, thank you for that. Isha Krishnaswamy, their podcaster and journalist. We appreciate your comments. And Dr. Fuad Azadi, their professor at the University of Tehran. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this news review.
Now moving on, Iranian security forces have arrested two Takfir terrorists linked to the so-called Daesh K or Daesh Khorasan terrorist group. According to Iranian media, the individuals are planning to enter a holy shrine in the Iranian city of Qom. The Daesh K is a branch of Daesh terrorist group that's active in Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's responsible for numerous deadly operations targeting civilians, including women and children. An Israeli airstrike has left dead seven international aid workers associated with a U.S.-based charity World Central Kitchen in the Gaza Strip.
The WCK team was traveling in a deconflicted zone in two armored cars branded with the WCK logo and a soft skin vehicle. Despite coordinating movements with the IDF, the convoy was hit as it was leaving the Deir al-Balah warehouse, where the team had unloaded more than 100 tons of humanitarian food aid brought to Gaza on the maritime route.
The head of the charity says that she's heartbroken and appalled over the loss of her team in the targeted attack in Gaza. Erin Gore called the airstrike unforgivable, saying that the attack was not only on World Central Kitchen, but on humanitarian bodies showing up in the direst of situations where food is being used as a weapon of war. The organization also announced it's halting all operations in the region. Meantime, Hamas has slammed the attack, saying that a regime is pursuing the policy of systematic killings to terrorize aid workers and disrupt humanitarian operations. Since the onset of the war in Gaza in early October, more than 32,900 Palestinians have been killed, mainly women and children. Motiba Musabe joined us earlier from Deir al-Balah in Gaza City with an update on the situation in the war-ravaged strip. He says Israel has continued with the strikes against residential buildings across the besieged territory.
So the Israeli forces committed at least seven appalling massacres, claiming the lives of 71 Palestinian civilians, in addition to injuring roughly 130 others. These numbers actually took the whole number of the Palestinian civilians who have been killed since the beginning of this onslaught on Gaza Strip to roughly 32,920 Palestinian civilians. Over the last couple of hours, the Israeli warplanes destroyed a residential building in the eastern part of Deir al-Balah city, particularly in Abu al-Ajin town, which is located in the eastern part of Deir al-Balah city. But while when it comes to Khan Yunis city, the western part of Khan Yunis city, particularly the vicinity and the surrounding areas of the Nasser Medical Complex, witnessed more destruction as more residential buildings were blown up by the Israeli occupation forces in that area, while the eastern part of Khan Yunis witnessed also another Israeli airstrikes and attacks against the residential buildings there. When it comes to Rafah city, the number of the Palestinian civilians who were killed over the last attack that took place during the last night amounted to 10 Palestinian civilians, including five Palestinian children, after they were attacked while they were sleeping inside their house. The Israeli occupation forces destroyed their house over their heads.
Now, meantime, Palestinians in the West Bank have endured intensified raids since the beginning of the Israeli regime's war on Gaza. Occupation forces have carried out fresh raids on towns, villages, and refugee camps across the occupied territories. Our correspondent there has more.
The Israeli troops stormed several villages, East Qalqilia, as well as South Qalqilia, like Jayus, Azun, and Habli, as well as Asli village. During the incursions to these villages, the Israeli troops stormed the Palestinians' homes, confiscated belongings, caused damage within the houses, and arrested a number of Palestinians. The Israeli troops had also stormed several areas around Al-Quds, like the refugee camp of Qalandia, for several hours. Exchange of fire have taken place between the Israeli forces and the residents of the refugee camp. The troops stormed the home of Mohammed Manasra, martyr Mohammed Manasra. He carried out an anti-Israeli operation in near the settlement of Ili, and he was shot and killed. Today, again, the Israeli forces stormed his home during this operation, and during the exchange of fire, a number of Palestinians had been wounded by the Israeli forces. At least 7 Palestinians were arrested from Colombia, a refugee camp. The Israeli troops in southern the occupied West Bank raided several towns in Al-Khalil area, raided the town of Beit Umar, and arrested at least 1 Palestinian, according to reports coming from Beit Umar. 14-year-old Palestinian was arrested by the Israeli forces.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding IRIB English Radio.
The Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another special edition of the program The Ocean of Dua. In this special edition during the holy month of Ramadan, we will be having a look at different parts of the supplication Abu Hamza Sumali. We will be bringing you different commentaries on some parts of this dua. We'll be back after you listen to these parts.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Ya Mawlai, بذكرك عاش قلبي وبمناجاتك بردت ألم الخوف عني فيا مولاي ويا مؤملي ويا منتهى سؤلي فرق بيني بين الذنب المانع لي من لزوم طاعتك فإنما أسألك لقديم الرجاء فيك وعظيم الطمع منك الذي أوجبته على نفسك من الرأفة والرحمة.
Dear listeners, brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we were discussing this part of supplication of Abu Hamza. يا مولاي بذكرك عاش قلبي وبمناجاتك بردت ألم الخوف عني. O my master, in your remembrance my heart takes delight, and with your prayers I can benumb the pains of fear tormenting me in this life. Regarding this part of the supplication, dear listeners, in the previous episodes we started discussion over the reality of remembrance and how important it was. It was the essence and spirit of different forms of worship, even the highest form of worship, which is Salat. Its spirit, its essence is remembrance. أَقِمِ الصَّلَاةَ لِذِكْرِي, the Holy Quran said. Afterwards, we moved on our discourse to the concept of the heart. We mentioned two important features for the heart,
And in the previous program specifically, we concluded that the heart can become the throne of the All-Beneficent if only the heart is obsessed with thoughts of hereafter. Even the heart can think about anything present in this physical world, but in order to make the most of for the other world. In the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam, if God has a place in the hearts of some, they pass their life in it in remembrance of Allah. Such hearts have a divine status. So if the heart is left alone, it will become a doorless abode. Caravans from different directions and regions come and go. It is possible the person himself is unaware of what is going on. But if the person controls his heart, if he takes the control of those doors, it is possible that he realizes how valuable the heart is. Then it is the time that the person will understand the capability of the heart for growth and evolution. Because heart is a precious diamond which is hidden under the flesh. And the brilliance of it will only be manifested if man takes the control of whatever goes in and out of the heart.
الهدى والفرقان فمن شهد منكم الشهر فليصم ومن كان مريضا أو على سفر فعدة من يريد الله بكم اليسر ولا يريد بكم العسر ولتكملوا العدة ولتكبروا الله على ما هداكم ولعلكم تشكرون.
The month of Ramadan is that in which was revealed the Quran, a guidance for the people and clear proofs of guidance and criterion. So whoever cites the new moon of the month, let him fast it. And whoever is ill or on a journey, then an equal number of other days. Allah intends for you ease and does not intend for you hardship, and wants for you to complete the period and to glorify Allah for that to which He has guided you, and perhaps you will be grateful.
Dear listeners, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam has said, the life of the heart lies in the remembrance of Allah. If the remembrance of Allah is not present in the heart, its value is equivalent to that which is the focus of its attention. One of its most important effects, pointed out by Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, is the life of the heart. Ya Mawlai, bidhikrika aasha qalbi. O my Lord, through your remembrance, my heart takes delight. Through your remembrance, my heart is alive. Life of the human beings exists on various levels. One level is plant life. Accordingly, we classify plants into living and dead or dry. A plant is living, and some indications of life are growth, development, and reproduction. Other characteristics of life are movement and perception. Now, the important thing is that man has both the flora and fauna levels of life. He grows and develops, as well as moving, perceiving, and sensing. Therefore, he is similar to the plants and animals both together. That is what we call life. Whenever we find movement and perception in a person simultaneously, we can say that he is alive. And as can be deduced from the noble Quran and traditions of the infallibles, man can have a life higher than that of plants and animals, which is the spiritual life. This superior life has some signs, and if a person does not possess them, he cannot be called a human. Although he is alive, although he is like the animals growing and developing, he is sensing, but we cannot call him human. We usually take animal life as human life, reproducing, breathing, eating and drinking, perceiving and moving and the like are conditions of plant and animal life. But human life is something else. We'll elaborate on that later on. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you throughout my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we talk to a small band of investigative journalists that have taken Ireland by storm. In a country where journalism has a sustained track record in upholding the establishment status quo, are we now seeing the unravelling of a decades-old marriage of convenience? So let's introduce today's guest. Joining me today is Owen McNeil, Polly Doyle, and Roman Shortall from The Ditch. Hi guys, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having us.
So first of all, Roman, I could ask you, for the audience's sake, what is The Ditch?
The Ditch, I suppose, is an online investigative journalism website. We set up about 3 years ago. I suppose we felt that there was a gap in the market for maybe a bit more focus on investigative journalism, and we didn't really know exactly how we were going to go about it, but we knew that we wanted to focus solely on investigative journalism, And I mean, we basically just, we started off, you know, kind of digging into public registers and land registry records and stuff like that. And, you know, that seems to be like our, it's still our bread and butter. And that's kind of what we've been focusing on for, nearly 3 years now.
And whose idea was it to come together?
Well, I had worked as a journalist kind of on and off over the last 10 years or so, and I'd worked on, this was, God, it's going back, it was during COVID, a story about Leo Varadkar leaking a document to one of his friends in a doctor's union, a story that was originally published by Village Magazine, and I would have worked on that. And it was kind of from that then, I'd been talking to Roman a wee bit on and off, just kind of phone calls and texts about that story first of all, and then Roman had been doing a bit of journalism himself in the background. Like he comes from a legal background himself, but he'd worked on a few other stories in the background, and it was partly just from these chats and kind of talking about what we thought the game was missing, and that, you know, that we thought that there wasn't a left-wing news outlet that kind of focused on things like land deals and property holdings and, you know, I suppose from some of our stuff, you know, like undeclared properties, all the rest. And we kind of thought, yeah, fuck it, why not, let's go and give it a go. And, you know, it was kind of, I'd say we would have spoken on and off, maybe, might have been 2 or 3 months maybe or so, and we've been gathering things and building things together. And then Roman had come across, it was a lovely story, and I have to say, like, we launched, as Roman said, was it March or April, 3 years ago, and Roman had come across, it was during COVID, and Micheál Martin, the most decent man in Ireland, as we all know, had, you know, during a time when there were very strict prohibitions on the kind of events you could hold and attend, he attended a prohibited event down in Cork that was just so happened to be held in honour of his father, Paddy the Champ Martin, who was an amateur boxer. And Roman came across this video of Micheál Martin attending this event, and he came across, in this video, he was telling an attending Garda to go and take her mask off for a wee photo opportunity, you know. And we just kind of thought, wow, that's great stuff, you know. And actually, funny enough, to go to Roman's point about, how there wasn't how we felt that there wasn't a whole lot of adversarial or confrontational journalism, the Cork Echo had actually covered this. I'm like, oh no, like, isn't Micheál Martin great? And we were kind of like, really? Like, you know, and look, myself and Roman have kind of talked about this since, you know, and that was the first story that we published, and it did kind of come from, you know, having spoken about it all for whatever, 2 or 3 months, and it got to the point where we just said, right, we have to go and do this now and then keep on doing it, you know. We felt we had to launch with a big story, and I think that kind of story was the only kind of story that we could launch on. I do think, like, if the Irish Times or the Irish Independent had published that story, I think Micheál Martin would have been in serious, serious danger. We kind of, you know, we kind of were hurt a little bit by the fact that, you know, people were going, who the fuck are the Ditch, like, you know. Since then, we kind of just kept on at it, and kind of started off maybe a story a week or so, and then we kind of ramped it up a wee bit, and now Paulie's come on board the last half year or so, like, so hopefully only bigger and better things.
That's it. And speaking of yourself, Paulie, I mean, why is this work important?
The short answer is that there was a lack of stories in the Irish media identifying wrongdoing on the part of people in positions of power and authority, right? And I was quite struck by, you know, how successful the guys had been, just the two of them, at, you know, holding people to account, identifying wrongdoing, in opposition to what the Irish media, you know, for the most part does and has historically done, which is kind of run stories about politics that are focused on personalities or rely on government sources to kind of leak them stories so the narrative is kind of shaped a certain way. And so I think it's important that there are outlets out there that kind of hold people to account and that they run these kinds of stories. And
And has it been, because I know when you crack that wee word, it's the same, and I've seen it in film,
How's the relationship between the likes of yourselves and others in journalism? Say for example, others that would have been comfortable with the status quo?
I think they're just kind of confused and vaguely annoyed by the emergence of the Ditch. There seems to be very much an attitude towards the Ditch that we're not somehow legitimate, right? You know, we'll run stories and the press will ignore them. And I think if they had another broadsheet had run them, they'd all end up kind of running them, if that makes sense. Sometimes the work that we do is acknowledged and other times it isn't. It seems to be kind of random in a way, you know.
I've got to say on that, like, I always kind of like it when you get, you know, a little bit of love or recognition from an unexpected source, you know, like where, you know, sometimes, yeah, I would agree with a lot of what Paulie has said, where there are mainstream journalists who don't like us or don't recognize us, whatever, and there are reasons for that, you know, but I found that was it the summer or was it kind of late spring when we had published all these stories about Niall Collins? Neil Martin gets up in the Dáil, goes on a diatribe, accuses us of being Russian assets, etc., etc., etc. And, you know, I was kind of surprised by... I went and did an interview with RTE after that, and it was kind of like... It was a guy called Justin Murphy, who, you know, I kind of knew what I was kind of getting myself in for, like, which is fine, you know, but, like... He kind of used the opportunity to hold me to account and kind of go, because me and Martin had said that we're a political organization, that, you know, we're not a, you know, a conventional journalistic outlet, you know, and I had to kind of answer for that, you know, whereas if it was a mainstream journalist, it would be a grave attack on the press. And certainly some of the reaction post that attack on us by Micheál Martin was kind of, yeah, similar to what your man Justin Murphy was like. But I have to say, very much respected Shane Ross in his Sunday Independent column that weekend. He called it out for what it was. You know, he called it out for an attack on the press, an attack on the media. He also, if I recall correctly, he compared Micheál Martin's rhetoric that day to be more fitting of someone like Putin, you know, in that it was an attack on the free press, you know. So I always enjoy that when, look, I wouldn't consider myself a liberal myself, you know, but I think when you do have... Sometimes, you know, people who actually abide by liberal principles like Shane Ross, like, I kind of did appreciate that, you know.
The good old Sunday Independent, eh? I'm sure some of you haven't had the misfortune of being called a troubled necrophiliac by the Sunday Independent.
Who was that in there?
That's for another day.
Was that RDE?
No. Yeah.
Sunday Independent isn't a political organisation, though. It's completely apolitical. Oh, yeah. And they just stick to the facts and all that kind of thing. If I was a political journalist, I would be asking myself, well, why haven't I considered to be some sort of a political operator, you know?
Yeah, well, it's not political to uphold the status quo, but it is political to challenge it, yeah, you know.
And Micheál Martin wouldn't actually repeat what he said outside of the Dáil as well, crucially.
I know, yeah.
Well, that is crucial.
We have to give credit, though, to the established media for doing a great job of holding us to account.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they might not want to hold the subjects of our stories to account, the people with actual power, but, yeah, they've certainly tried to hold us to account. It seems we only kind of get the phone call... you know, from RTE or other establishment media organisations, when we're in trouble, or they think we're in trouble, that's when they want to talk to us.
Of course.
You know, but when we've a big story, you know, and someone else is in trouble, they don't really want to hear from us.
Well, that's par for the course, as you well know now, Roman. Owen, just getting back to yourself, you had recently written a piece for Red Roof on the hate speech bill. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, look, I mean, I just think it's a terrible piece of legislation for so many reasons. It's a proposed hate speech act that it's working its way through the Oireachtas at the moment. It's gone through the Dáil and it's to come before the Seanad. It's what can you say about it? It's, you know, it's incredibly far reaching. It effectively the parts that I'd be most worried about are the the powers that it would give the Gardaí in investigating so-called hate offences, and the power that the guards would have for investigation of people's devices and homes. And part of this bill, you know, aims to combat transphobic hate crime, right? And as part of that, it would empower the Gardaí to investigate these potential crimes. But, you know, the Guards are an organization that shelved an internal gender policy because, in the words of Antoinette Cunningham, who is she's a representative of one of the Gardaí unions, like, she said that a lot of the guards don't know about this kind of thing, like, you know, and that, you know, under this policy, you know, guards would have been possibly subject to disciplinary measures if they misgendered their colleagues, you know, and the guards say, oh no, like, we can't do this. Like, so, like, these are the guys that we're supposedly looking to combat these crimes. And I kind of find that the bit that I find that I continue to find most frustrating about it is the fact that the loudest opponents of this bill are generally from the right. And, you know, these are people who I said in the piece I wrote for you that, you know, these are people who have been in paroxysms of over phrases like "from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." You know, these people think that chant is beyond the pale, and they've been in hysterics over that. But neither opposing this bill on the grounds of, they, as they would say, free speech. That's another kind of one that grinds my gears a wee bit. I always kind of find when Irish people talk about free speech, that to me is a bit of an Americanism. Like, I always think of freedom of expression. But anyway, I also just think that the left, or the nominal left, or the broad left, whatever you want to call it, has kind of ceded a lot of ground to the right in opposing this bill. And I think it's kind of wild in a country with our history of censorship, you know, on the censorship of even published discussion about abortion, and then particularly with Section 31, which I kind of do think that a lot of what you've been saying and what Paulie and Roman have been saying about this kind of whatever you want to call it, a toothlessness or kind of an impotence of the Irish establishment media, I think it's a legacy of Section 31, where, you know, obviously Section 31 first introduced in, I think it was 1960, in the Broadcasting Act, and then it was later in the 70s where measures were introduced to ban Republicans from the airwaves. Effectively, there were different ministers involved, you know, but one minister who certainly came down hard and certainly used these measures quite prodigiously was Conor Cruise O'Brien, a man who later joined the UK Unionist Party. But you could see, like, throughout the course of Section 31, you know, there are kind of, there were little, whatever you want to call it, you know, pockets of resistance to it, where I think there was one reporter who interviewed Sean McJiffan, and he interviewed him and then just read a transcript of what he had said. So technically, Sean McJiffan wasn't broadcast over the airwaves. This drove government mad, like, you know, and then they kind of clamped down on it again. The end result of this was government telling journalists what they can and can't publish. And, like, yeah, there were acts of resistance along the way, but broadly speaking, these guys just said, oh yeah, cool. Like, if Conor Cruise O'Brien says we shouldn't interview these guys, I'm going to go with him. And people get up on their high horse about this term, but I mean, if you can't call Conor Cruise O'Brien a West Brit, who can you call? You know, when he was, it's just like, so to me, it's just kind of crazy that, you know, anyone who considers themselves broadly progressive could support this bill. But then you'll see people then like Claire Byrne, who's an RTE presenter. She was questioning. She was interviewing Liam Herrick from the Irish Council for Civil Liberties, and, you know, like, one of the lines of questioning that she put to him was, "Oh well, Donald Trump Jr. and Elon Musk oppose this? Are you happy to be in their corner? And it's just like, is that the extent of your feelings on this? That like, all right, well, these bad people are opposing it, we better oppose it too? You know, just kind of, yeah, I mean, like, I think, yeah, what I would like to see would be, you know, more progressive, liberal, left, socialist opposition to the bill, because it's a terrible piece of legislation anyway, but it's particularly bad in a country like Ireland.
So getting to the meat on the bones, start with you, Paulie. What, for the audience's sake, tell us about some of the big catches that you've had.
Well, the big story that we had this year was that Leo Varadkar had misled SIPO when they had asked him about a number of donations that were undeclared. Now, to explain that, so under the law, if you receive a donation from an individual that's or a company over 600 euro, you have to declare it, and that donation cannot exceed 1,000 euro, right? So SIPO wrote to him in 2019, and they said, Edelman bought a table at a fundraiser event that you ran. We found that it wasn't declared, so can you please explain that? Varadkar's explanation was that Edelman had been reimbursed by the individuals who were at the table, so therefore it didn't count as a donation exceeding 1,000 euro, and none of it had to be declared because they were, you know, 100 euro, 200 euro apiece. SIPO then checked with Edelman, and they said, is this what happened here? Edelman wrote back and said, no, actually, that's not what happened. And that then brought something that Leo Varadkar had said explaining a donation from them in 2022 into question as well. There were other undeclared donations from 2018 that year. One of them was from a barrister. One of them was from the Attorney General, well, the now Attorney General, Rossa Fanning. And the other one was from Centric Health, right? SIPO wrote to Leo saying, are you satisfied? Now, he'd given the same explanation for, you know, these other donations, saying they were all reimbursed, so I didn't have to declare them. They'd written to him saying, you know, can you explain, one, why Edelman are contradicting you, and two, you know, are you satisfied that this explanation, you know, accounts for what's happened with these other donations? And he just ignored them, right? Because Leo Varadkar doesn't have to answer questions to anyone, apparently. He doesn't have to. So he just refused to.
And it's SIPO as well.
And it's SIPO as well, which is completely toothless, yeah, right? Yeah. So he just said, instead of engaging with them and accounting for what he'd done, he was just like, no, I'm not going to answer that. And then they wrote to him again. And we did a story on it. And we asked him about it. And Leo Varadkar then released a statement to us saying, I can confirm that I am not under investigation by SIPO, which was I think he was trying to get off on a kind of a technical term, because it was like an inquiry and maybe not technically an investigation or something
very
like that.
Response.
Well, we actually never said he was under investigation. We were careful with the language because of how the legislation is worded, and we said that it was, we used words like probe and everything.
SIPO is investigating, which is the language that the mainstream press use whenever SIPO stick an oar into Sinn Féin's business. It's always, oh, SIPO is investigating, so, but can't say about Leo Varadkar.
See, this as well, though, that was one of the instances where the media did pick it up, and they ran with the headline, Leo Varadkar confirms that he is not under investigation by SIPO. And there was also one journalist who's quite well known, who contacted us kind of asking for what we had to back up, you know, what we said in the story. So, you know, we kind of, you know, made sure that we sent it on to him, and he didn't do anything with it, so I'm convinced that it was a fact-finding mission.
Sounds like it. And yourself, Roman, what would you say would be one of the biggest stories that you've worked on?
I'd say probably my favourite story last year was the Niall Collins story that we did. So Niall Collins is a junior minister. He's the Minister of State for Further Education. And the first story that we did, I think, was at the beginning of last year, related to a planning application that he had made, a historic planning application. And basically on that planning application, he lied and said that he was living with his parents in order to circumvent planning rules, very strict planning rules, relating to one-off dwellings. He wanted to build a one-off dwelling in Limerick, where he's from. And the problem was he already owned a house, so he didn't have a housing need. So in order to get around that, as I said, he basically just lied. And he said he was living with his parents, he didn't own any property, and he got planning permission to build that house. I mean, some people would say, that there's, and it is quite controversial, the one-off housing rules, they still exist. And a lot of people would say that, they're problematic. And I think a lot of people would tell fibs on the applications to kind of get around these things. But this guy is a lawmaker, and a lot of people who do things like that would have to face consequences for it. So we ran that story, and I guess he kind of managed to weasel his way out of it. And the media kind of ran with whatever he was saying. He came into the Dáil and gave a statement, and, I think he thought that was the end of it. We did a little bit more digging, and it turned out that his wife had purchased a parcel of land in Limerick that was owned by the council. And a month before the council voted to sell that piece of land, his wife had written in to the council and said, I want to buy this piece of land. He voted. He was one of the people that voted. His Fianna Fáil colleagues proposed the motion at a council meeting. He was a councillor at the time. And they voted to sell the piece of land, which his wife then bought. And basically no consequences. He's still a minister. There is a Garda investigation into it. I believe it's not an investigation stage. They've said that they're doing a scoping exercise to see if any legislation was broken, which it seems it might have been, the Local Government Act, which states you have to recuse yourself when you've a potential beneficial interest. And there's also a complaint made to the Standards and Public Office Commission. But he's still junior minister for further education. And there were a lot of other stories that we did on Niall Collins. A lot of, I would say, dodgy dealings, relating to himself. And, he hasn't really had to properly account for any of it,
Listen, lads, it's great to have you up in Belfast. What we're going to do now is we're going to leave the studio and work on our plans over the next coming month. And, I'm looking forward to it. So, Owen, Paulie, Roman, thank you for coming to the show.
Thank you very much.
And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's programme to help us grow our audience across all our social media platforms. I'd once again like to thank our special guests, Owen McNeill, Paulie Doyle and Roman Shorthall from The Ditch. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that the evil Israeli regime will be punished for its deadly air raid on the Iranian embassy in Syria. 7 foreign aid workers are killed in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza as the death toll from the regime's genocide tops 32,900. Meantime, the Israeli regime conducts fresh raids across the occupied West Bank as part of intensified crackdown on Palestinians.